Content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the June 25th, 2015 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Jeb joins the Republican fray. What happened? Jeb Bush formally launched his presidential campaign this week, portraying himself as the most accomplished Republican candidate and insisting he wants to be judged as his own man, not by his family name. Speaking in Miami in both English and Spanish, the former Florida governor told supporters that the country's economy was on a very bad course and pledged to replicate on a national scale the 4% growth Florida experienced during his two terms in office. "I know we can fix this," he said, "because I've done it." In a sign, Bush will seek to distance himself from the baggage attached to his father's and brother's presidencies. He unveiled a campaign logo that reads simply, "Jeb." In life and in politics, he said, "I found my own path." The announcement caps a six-month shadow campaign during which Bush raised millions of dollars but saw his poll ratings slide. He is now bunched at the top of a crowded field with his former protege, Florida Senator Marco Rubio, and Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. In his speech, Bush, 62, launched a thinly veiled attack on Rubio and other senators, saying, "There's no passing off responsibility when you're a governor." He also directly criticized both President Obama and presumptive Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton, warning that the presidency should not be passed on from one liberal to the next. What the editorial said: if the Republican Party were able to design an ideal candidate, it would look very much like Jeb Bush, said the Economist. He was a popular conservative governor in a key swing state. He cut taxes and slashed the state workforce, and he speaks fluent Spanish. There's just one problem: his surname. To succeed, Bush has to distance himself from both his father, whom many conservatives have never forgiven for breaking a promise not to raise taxes, and his brother, who as president allowed federal spending and borrowing to soar and launched the now unpopular Iraq War. Bush's biggest problem is not his family baggage, said the Washington Post. It's the Republican base, which prefers conservative tantrum throwing to sound conservative governance. Unlike most of the pandering GOP herd, Bush favors a pathway to legal status for illegal immigrants, supports the eminently sensible Common Core educational standards, and refuses to sign Grover Norquist's anti-tax hike pledge. Unless the GOP expands its appeal to immigrants and young voters, said USA Today, the party is doomed to failure. Whatever his problems, Bush is the type of nominee the GOP needs if it wants to win the White House. What the columnist said: a few months ago, John Ellis, Jeb Bush, thought this nomination was in the bag, said Noah Rotham in CommentaryMagazine.com. But the donations to his campaign are already drying up, and the Republican field is bigger than ever. Jeb Bush has been humbled, and he now knows he'll have to win over conservatives if he wants the nomination. Yet there's a reason Bush remains among the favorites, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. His accomplishments in office far exceed those of Rubio and Walker. And despite his dynastic heritage, Bush can run as an outsider, a governor who accomplished things Washington seems incapable of doing. Yes, he stumbled a few weeks ago when asked if invading Iraq was a mistake, But few people outside the Washington Beltway are paying attention to presidential politics 17 months before the election. What matters is what comes next. Bush is reportedly planning to destroy Rubio and Walker with a scorched earth attack on their qualifications, said Rehan Salam in Slate.com. This is deeply worrisome for Republicans. If Bush fails, he might leave the GOP nominee unelectable. If Bush succeeds, he will very likely lose to Clinton. The Bush brand is tarnished, and the election will be decided by the question, which candidate cares about people like me? Fairly or unfairly, Jeb, the introverted, wonky heir of a political dynasty, just doesn't come off as a man of the people. That's why yet another Bush candidacy could be a lose-lose proposition for the GOP. And a second main story, Al-Qaeda's number two taken out. Al-Qaeda suffered its most devastating leadership loss in years when the terrorist network's second-in-command was killed last week by a U.S. drone strike in Yemen. Nasser al-Wuhashi, the leader of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, AQAP, once served as Osama bin Laden's personal secretary and had been expected to eventually replace Amin al-Zawahiri as Al-Qaeda's leader. Al-Qaeda's confirmation of al-Wuhashi's death came just 2 days after U.S. military officials said that F-15 airstrikes in Libya were believed to have killed Mokhtar Belmokhtar, an al-Qaeda-allied jihadist who orchestrated a 2013 attack on an Algerian gas plant that killed 38 foreign workers. Al-Wuhashi's death has deprived Al-Qaeda of a dynamic heavyweight, said Tim Lister and Paul Cruikshank in CNN.com. Under his leadership, AQAP became the only Al-Qaeda affiliate capable of both taking territory on its home turf and planning sophisticated attacks overseas. The 2009 and 2010 plots to use concealed bombs to destroy U.S.-bound planes and this year's massacre at French newspaper Charlie Hebdo were all hatched by AQAP from its redoubt in Yemen's mountainous southeast. But this whack-a-mole strategy isn't making much of a difference on the ground, said Molly O'Toole in NationalJournal.com. Terrorist leaders can be replaced, and AQAP has already named a successor to al-Wuhashi. Even when airstrikes do damage al-Qaeda, other militant groups simply fill the vacuum. In war-torn Yemen and Libya, fighters who were once allied with al-Qaeda are now transferring their allegiance to the increasingly powerful Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. These strikes aren't supposed to defeat the jihadist threat, just contain it, said Greg Miller in the Washington Post. As long as there are no strong central governments in Libya and Yemen, Islamist terrorists will continue to take advantage of the chaos and make gains in recruitment, territory, and influence. War-weary Americans won't support another U.S.-led nation-building enterprise in the Muslim world. So that leaves the Obama administration with one option: finding the most wanted terrorist and delivering lethal blows from above. Our controversy of the week. Hillary, is it smart for her to run as a liberal? Are voters ready for yet another new Hillary? Asked Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. After months of disastrous news stories about her private email server and the shady finances of the Clinton Foundation, a reboot was clearly necessary for the Democratic presidential frontrunner. So last week, Hillary Clinton officially relaunched her campaign with a 45-minute policy speech that signaled a sharp left turn on virtually every issue. delivered on New York City's Roosevelt Island, named for the president who created the modern welfare state. Clinton's speech sounded like a 21st century left liberal laundry list, said John Podhertz in New York Post. She pledged herself to the causes of gay rights, equal pay for women, and climate change. Called for a higher minimum wage and universal pre-kindergarten education. And, somewhat incredibly, for a multimillionaire who has repeatedly pocketed six-figure speaking fees from corporations and Wall Street banks, even declared war on the powerful forces of the financial industry. The hand-picked crowd of liberal supporters roared its approval, but Clinton's government-centered vision of America's future represents nothing more than Obama 3.0. Hillary hasn't moved to the left. The country has, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. Growing ethnic diversity and tolerance has turned social issues such as same-sex marriage from a Republican strength into a weakness, while inequality has created widespread skepticism of Republican trickle-down economics. For Hillary to focus on appealing to centrist voters, as her husband did in 1992, would make no sense. Today, America is so polarized that so-called independents consistently vote for one party or the other. So Clinton is better off firing up and mobilizing the Democratic base. Besides, Clinton's always been a liberal, said Matthew Iglesias in Vox.com. Yes, she may have voted for the war in Iraq, a vote she has since called a mistake. But her overall record in the Senate was more liberal than Barack Obama's. As First Lady, she was widely seen as a fierce advocate of progressive positions, often at odds with those of her triangulating centrist husband. Sorry, but running a diverse and partisan campaign is a mistake, said David Brooks in the New York Times. The country badly needs unifying leaders to heal our partisan divisions and reacquaint America with the virtues of political compromise. And how does Clinton expect to govern if she wins? With the GOP all but certain to keep the House and very likely the Senate as well, a President Clinton will need Republican help to get anything passed. If she spent her campaign demonizing the GOP as racist, woman-hating robber barons, she will make our broken politics even worse. In the end, Clinton's campaign promises don't really matter, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. Even if she wins, the Republican lock on Congress means her agenda will go nowhere, and she'll be mired in the same gridlock that's frustrated President Obama. This presidential election nonetheless carries hugely important stakes. Virtually all of the GOP candidates have pledged to sign Representative Paul Ryan's infamous budget proposal, which would slash tax rates on the rich, make massive cuts in Medicaid, food stamps, and other social programs, and deregulate the energy and banking industries. If Jeb Bush, Scott Walker, or Marco Rubio wins, we'll see the most dramatic rollback of government since the New Deals. If Clinton wins, she'll veto the Ryan budget. That, by far, is the most important issue of the campaign. Well, it was a good week for liberty after the Iowa Supreme Court overturned a prior conviction and upheld a woman's right to be drunk at home. Police had charged Patience Pay, 29, with public intoxication after she blew a 2.67 on a breathalyzer test conducted on her front steps. It was a good week for tax evasion after a brothel owner in Austria, where prostitution is legal, announced plans to offer free sex in protest over what he calls the unfair taxation of his business. And it was a good week for the circus. After Donald Trump launched his Republican presidential campaign in a rambling speech in which he vowed to beat ISIS by taking back that oil, characterized many Mexican immigrants as drug dealers, criminals, and rapists, and mocked the other GOP candidates as all talk, no action. It was a bad week for decoys after London police engaged in a prolonged standoff with a venomous adder they were told was lying very still on a patio until they realized the snake was a garden ornament. It was a bad week for hagiography after a $29 million FIFA-produced movie about its disgraced president, Sepp Blatter, made just $607 in its opening weekend in 10 U.S. theaters, with one critic calling it a squirm-inducing heap of propaganda. And it was a bad week for stealing signs after the FBI revealed that it is investigating baseball's St. Louis Cardinals over allegations that the team hacked into the private computer systems of the Houston Astros to get scouting reports and other player information. It would be the first ever corporate espionage case involving pro sports teams. And we'll take a look at the briefing page. China's territory grab. China is aggressively laying claim to most of the South China Sea. What's at stake? What is China claiming? China has issued an audacious map claiming it as its territory practically the entire South China Sea and all its islands. The delineated area reaches hundreds of miles from the Chinese mainland, nearly all the way to the coast of Vietnam, Malaysia, and the Philippines. Under maritime law, each country claims the sea 12 nautical miles out from its coastline as its own territory. And it can also claim an economic zone 200 miles out, within which it can control fishing and mining rights. China is leaving its neighbors only their 12 miles and claiming the rest. It says, for example, that it owns the Spratly Islands. That archipelago is also claimed by the Philippines, Taiwan, and Vietnam. And unlike China, those countries have each established their claim with an airport and a small military outpost in the otherwise uninhabited islands. To remedy that, China is building its own islands in the Spratlys. It says these artificial islands are for peaceful civilian purposes, but there are indications it intends to establish military bases on them. How is it making islands? China has built and deployed gigantic dredgers the size of skyscrapers that can move more than 4,000 cubic meters of sand and rock every hour. The vessels are dredging out deep water harbors suitable for large ships and dumping massive amounts of sand onto reefs to build islands big enough for military bases. More than 2,000 acres of new land have been formed, mostly in the past 6 months. China is not wasting any time trying to get these islands created, infrastructure built, and populated, said James Hardy of Jane's Defense Weekly. One of the seven new islands is almost 2 miles long and sports a nearly completed airstrip suitable for fighter jets. Is this legal? That's a complicated issue. Maritime law does not recognize man-made islands as territory giving a nation sovereignty over waters or airspace. China does have some historic claim to parts of the sea, but then so do many other countries. Brunei, Malaysia, Taiwan, the Philippines, and Vietnam have all used or occupied some of the shoals and islands at various periods in history, and all have submitted legal claims at the United Nations. Yet China refuses to submit to UN arbitration. Instead, it is moving ahead, taking existing islands or building new ones with military hardware expected to come next. The fear is that China will turn the sea into a Chinese lake, said Rajiv Ranjan Chaturvedi of the Institute of South Asian Studies in Singapore. Why is the region so important? The South China Sea is flush with resources and has great strategic significance. The region's fisheries provide food and jobs for millions of people in the surrounding countries. Vast, untapped oil and natural gas reserves are believed to lie under sea. Even more importantly, the sea encompasses key global shipping lanes and sees five times more oil tanker traffic than the Panama Canal. Five of the world's 10 busiest shipping ports are located there. Were China to control access to the sea, it could disrupt oil and trade shipments to all of East and Southeast Asia, paralyzing these nations' economies. How is China asserting its claim? Over the past 3 years, China has been occupying the Scarborough Shoal, a triangle of reefs in the South China Sea long claimed by the Philippines. The two countries had a standoff over fishing rights, and after U.S. mediation, both agreed to withdraw their warships. But China reneged on the deal, and the shoal is now patrolled by Chinese ships and exclusively fished by Chinese fishermen. Last year, China stationed an oil rig near Paracel Islands, claimed by Vietnam. In 2013, China announced an air defense identification zone in the East China Sea, claiming control of the skies near Japan and South Korea. Last week, it threatened to do the same in the South China Sea. Already, the Chinese Navy has warned off a U.S. Navy surveillance plane that was flying over one of its new artificial islands, broadcasting again and again, "This is Chinese Navy. You are approaching our military alert zone. Leave immediately." What is the U.S. response? The U.S. insists that China has no sovereignty over those waters. The United States will fly, sail, and operate wherever international law allows, Defense Secretary Ashton Carter said. We will remain the principal security power in the Asia-Pacific for decades to come. The U.S. had asked China to stop building islands, but since China refuses, the U.S. is concentrating on reassuring its allies that it will protect freedom of navigation. It has defense treaties with Taiwan and the Philippines, and it just lifted a ban on selling weapons to Vietnam. The Pentagon is reportedly considering plans to send ships and aircraft within 12 nautical miles of the artificial islands, but some U.S. military officials fear that would be needlessly provocative. There aren't any silver bullets to resolving this, said Assistant Defense Secretary David Shear. Challenging the U.S. naval supremacy. The world's fastest-growing economy, China has channeled a good chunk of its economic growth into the military, raising the defense budget by more than 10% a year for most of the past 25 years. In its new military doctrine, China announced it is greatly expanding its navy so it can respond to provocative actions in the South China Sea. It is bolstering its already substantial submarine fleet, adding subs armed with nuclear missiles that can reach 4,500 miles. By 2020, China is expected to deploy 342 submarines and missile-firing warships, compared with 243 ships and submarines for the U.S. China commissioned its first aircraft carrier in 2012. And says it will finish two more this year. It also has long-range anti-ship ballistic missiles that could threaten U.S. aircraft carriers. The maritime battlefield has been broadened, said Colonel Wang Jin, and China's Navy needs to react to protect its rights globally. The first of our columns this week also deals with China. John Schindler at thedailybeast.com writes, "Losing the spy war to China." This was the biggest data compromise since Edward Snowden stole 1.7 million classified documents and fled to Russia, said former National Security Agency counterintelligence officer John Schindler. The Chinese hacker who stole the personnel records of more than 4 million current and past federal employees, it was revealed this week, also obtained the files of every government worker who's had a security clearance, including many intelligence operatives. This is a genuine debacle for Washington because these files include the workers' vices and personal problems, including gambling and drug histories, sexual affairs, and credit troubles. Beijing can now exploit this gold mine of information to detect and expose U.S. spies abroad and to blackmail intelligence agents or other federal employees. Since the security clearance files also include the names of workers' spouses, children, and friends here and abroad, the number of people exposed is horrifying. Every intelligence agent now has to wonder what China knows and how much it will share. For them, this is a matter of life and death. We'd better face a grim reality. China is winning the spy war. From Ireland, Alison O'Connor at the Irish Examiner. Time for a right to abortion. Ireland may have legalized gay marriage, but we're still one of the most backward Western countries when it comes to abortion, said Alison O'Connor. After a woman died in Galway Hospital in 2012 because doctors refused to terminate her unviable pregnancy, Ireland legalized abortion in cases where there is a substantial risk to a woman's life. But how much of a risk counts? A 50% risk of death? A 10% risk? A doctor deemed to have made a wrong decision to terminate can face 14 years in prison, and so can the woman. Of course, Irish women do seek abortions. Some 4,000 go abroad for the purpose every year. Hearing their stories could change public opinion, just as hearing the stories of gay people did for marriage equality. Amnesty International recently put out a report, "She Is Not a Criminal," compiling those narratives. The woman who was forced to keep carrying a fetus with no heartbeat until she fled abroad. The refugee who was repeatedly raped by a paramilitary group in her homeland and was denied an abortion after arriving in Ireland. Now that the Irish can no longer pretend we don't know the horrors, we may finally face up maturely to this problem. From Tanzania, this is an editorial from the Daily News, albinos are not magical. When will Tanzanians shed their superstitions about albinos, asked Tanzania's Daily News. Just last month, an albino Tanzanian woman, a mother of four, had her hand chopped off by traffickers who planned to sell it to witch doctors. These charlatans spread the lie that the skin, hair, and other bodily parts of people with albinism have supernatural or hyper-healing powers. Of course, it's all sheer nonsense. But so many people believe these lies that there is a lucrative market for portions and amulets made from the body parts of our albino citizens. President Jakaya Kikwete has pledged a government effort to end the killings and amputations, but stricter punishments for witch doctors will only go so far. It's time for a national education campaign to make all Tanzanians aware of what causes albinism. It is simply a congenital defect resulting in the absence of tyrosinase, an enzyme that helps make melanin. People with albinism are human beings like any other, no more or less special than the rest of us, and their skin has no magical properties. Our albino citizens, our neighbors, our relatives will only be truly safe when the rest of us stop believing those with warped minds and listen instead to science. Our in-depth article this week returns to the topic of Jeb Bush, but this time about his wife, titled Jeb's Very Private Wife. Columba Bush married into a high-profile political clan, said Hannah Rosen, but she hates the spotlight. Now and then, in an otherwise unmemorable speech, Jeb Bush will drop a mention of his wife, like a sudden pop of color. At an event in Nevada this March, Bush opened with a husband-still-in-thrall routine. His life, he said, can be divided into two parts, BC and AC, before Columba and after Columba, referring to Columba Garnisa de Gallo, the woman he fell madly in love with while on a high school trip to Mexico, and then married 41 years ago. The crowd, full of seniors and some Spanish speakers, awed and cheered. Columba herself was not in attendance. Friends of the Bush family to this day tell stories of Jeb and Columba's deep and obvious affection for each other. And yet, by any straightforward measure of compatibility, family backgrounds, interests, personality, ideas about a pleasant way to spend an afternoon, they seem to have very little in common. Take, for example, her husband's lifelong career passion and the main preoccupation of his family for at least three generations. In 2001, after Columba had been the First Lady of Florida for 2 years, a reporter asked whether she and her husband talked about state policy. "Never," she answered. "We talk about our daughter and sons, and cats and dogs, and silly things." The role of political spouse always entails sacrifice, but Columba's case has been extreme. Jeb's time in office coincided with stretches when Columba was reportedly unhappy because of his absence or because of troubles with one of their three children, or because she herself had landed in the news in ways that mortified her. It was during Jeb Bush's governing years that Columba let it slip to the press how her husband's career had damaged their children, and that she reportedly told Jeb he had ruined her life. During his governorship, which ran from 1999 to 2007, she often retreated to Miami while he was living in Tallahassee. All of which makes you wonder what it will be like for her to live through a national campaign and possibly a presidency, during which the mode of being she's enjoyed least will become her entire existence. In the Jackie Kennedy years, she might have gotten away with a smile, a few supporting speeches, and an appropriate cause or two. But feminist resistance to the idea of wife as silent prop has in some ways put more pressure on a first lady to be serious and comfortable in front of the camera, giving someone like Columba no easy place to hide. Despite her in-laws' history and her own 8 years as the First Lady of Florida, Columba has consistently talked about politics as if it were something that faraway alien people do. In 1992, when a reporter from the Miami Herald asked her whether she was enjoying her father-in-law's presidential campaign, she said, "I want to go back to my kitchen, to do the homework with my kids, and, why not, to watch television." It's true that she has adopted First Lady-worthy causes, working with the Florida Coalition Against Domestic Violence and the Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse. Everyone I interviewed who's worked with her said she doesn't seek the limelight or even any recognition for her actions, which is admirable. It's admirable, too, that she's been able to remain, well, normal, despite her marriage into such a high-powered political clan. But as a modern first lady, she'd be expected to come out from behind the scenes. Jeb Bush's courting of Columba at 17 is possibly the most outlandish thing he's ever done. In a family where the sons traditionally choose their wives from a small society circle, Jeb's choice registered as baffling, even reckless. in 1970 as a senior at Phillips Academy, a boarding school in Andover, Massachusetts. He took a class called Man and Society, which explored poverty, conflicts, and the dynamics of power. At the end of the winter term, the students could choose to spend 3 months either in a poor neighborhood in South Boston or in a poor indigenous village outside León, Mexico. Jeb was from Texas and already studying Spanish. Along with 10 other classmates, he opted to skip the Boston winter. "We actually built a schoolhouse," Jeb's former classmate, Laurie Bump, told me. In the late afternoons, the students would all meet up in the main plaza in León and eat. And then in the evenings, they'd sometimes get together at one of the houses where they were staying to drink and play poker. As Jeb tells the story, one day he saw 16-year-old Columba across the plaza, and it was love at first sight. Lightning is how he put it to the Boston Globe. She was not a society girl from Mexico City. Even by standards of small-town León, she was on the social fringe. Relatives have described her as the free-spirited daughter of a divorced mother in a community where, in her own words, divorce was a sin. From the start, Jeb told his classmates that he was in love. At the end of the trip, he told them all he was not going home with them. Instead, he was taking Columba on a trip to Acapulco. To Jeb's friends, it looked like meeting Columba allowed Jeb to settle into who he actually was. Before that Mexico trip, Jeb had been known in school as a good tennis player, an indifferent student, a bit of a bully, and a toker, a guy whose room you go to in order to get high. "I was a cynical little turd at a cynical school," he said once. Yet by the time Jeb returned to Andover, he had matured. He made the honor roll for the first time and shared a prize for a history paper. He just wasn't messing around as much with drugs and alcohol, Bump recalled. Everyone knew he had changed. "We figured he was just devoted to her." The partying and restlessness that characterized his older brother, George W., into his 40s, Jeb got out of his system before he turned 18. He graduated from college in 2.5 years, thanks to a newfound focus, he once said. During the holidays in 1973, he proposed to Columba in Spanish at a Mexico City restaurant. She took a day to answer, then gave him a peace symbol ring. Jeb did not introduce Columba to his father until a small dinner right before the wedding. "How I worry about Jeb and Columba," Barbara Bush wrote in her diary. "Does she love him?" The wedding took place at the Catholic Student Center at the University of Texas at Austin. Columba spoke no English, so parts of the service were conducted in Spanish. After Jeb graduated college with a degree in Latin American studies, he and Columba moved to Venezuela, where he became a vice president of the Texas Commerce Bank. The couple spoke Spanish at home. Their eldest son's first words were agua, jugo, and aquí, water, juice, and here. In 1979, when Jeb's father began creating a presidential campaign network, Jeb and his family moved to Miami to help him out. Miami turned out to be perfect, both for the family and for Jeb's ambitions. He ran for chairman of Dade County's Republican Party and won, the first political win for his generation of Bushes. 20 years later, Jeb Bush became governor as Florida was changing, enabling him to add Central Americans and Puerto Ricans to his list of constituents and allies. Over time, he became what his friend and Republican strategist Anna Navarro calls pan-Hispanic, meaning he speaks Spanish fluently, with an accent that's not detectable as Cuban or Nicaraguan or Mexican, and has an understanding of each specific culture's idiosyncrasies. Jorge L. Arizurieta, a Miami businessman and longtime friend of Jeb's, calls him a gringo aplatanado, by which he means the most Latino American you will ever see. Columba has made about as vast a journey as any American immigrant ever could. from a barely middle-class girl raised by a divorced single mother in León to potential first lady of an American presidential franchise. Yet today, Columba is no more a part of Jeb Bush's Spanish-speaking political circles than she is of his English-speaking ones. She did not develop a separate life in Miami society pages or become a well-known hostess on the city's Cuban scene. In fact, as Jeb was smoothly going native, her own cultural transition to Bushland was halting and bumpy. She became an American citizen in 1979, just so she could vote for her father-in-law for president. It was a difficult decision to make, she later told a local paper. In 1994, Jeb ran for governor and lost. He campaigned 6 days a week, morning and night, only slowing down when he was dog sick, he said. His wife, meanwhile, was home and overwhelmed with raising teenage children. One of them had a drug problem. Only years later did they publicly admit that it was their daughter, Noelle. George P., then a Rice University student, was caught by police that year breaking into an ex-girlfriend's house at 4 a.m. to see her. A biography of the Bushes reports that during that period, several family members overheard Columba say to Jeb, "You've ruined my life." In 1998, Jeb ran for governor again and won. The family relocated to Tallahassee, and as First Lady, Columba changed the look of the governor's mansion. She organized exhibits of the works of Salvador Dali, Diego Rivera, and Frida Kahlo, and her favorite local artists. This did not always go over well in a city culturally much further removed from Miami than the 500 miles between them would suggest. She was doing Latina, not Southern Belle, Jim Towie, one of George W. Bush's presidential advisors, recalled. Eventually, she and Jeb agreed she'd spend more of her time in Miami. In 1999, shortly after Jeb won the gubernatorial election, she faced public scrutiny. Returning to the U.S. from a trip to Paris, Columba told customs officials that she'd spent $500 on overseas purchases. She was searched, however, and officials found receipts for $19,000 in clothes and jewelry. A Bush spokesman at the time said she had not wanted her husband to know how much she had spent. "The embarrassment I felt made me ashamed to face my family and friends," Columba said at a charity event later that year. "It was the worst feeling I've ever had in my life." She also said, "I did not ask to join a famous family. I simply wanted to marry the man I loved." After the couple left the governor's mansion in 2007, they lived a relatively normal life for the first time in many years, with no security, no public schedule. A few years into that period, Jeb began to soften. Towie recalled a birthday dinner this year that lasted 2 hours, where Jeb was happy to have his grandkids crawling over his lap, helping him blow out the candles. Towie got the sense that the couple had grown closer and that Columba had had the space to realize that her husband wasn't just a political junkie. Early this year, Columba had lunch at the Biltmore Hotel in Miami, where Jeb likes to golf in the early mornings, with Bart Hudson, the president of the Florida House, the only state embassy in Washington, D.C. Hudson politely asked after her husband, as he always does, and she said something unusual. "Jeb," she said, "was an artist at what he does," Hudson told me. "That's the highest compliment she can give anyone," he said. "It means that she appreciates the depths of what he does." Perhaps if Jeb becomes president, Columba will get away with a few practiced public speeches and some behind-the-scenes charity work. Perhaps she will get away with letting her sons do the bulk of the talking for the family. Maybe the most interesting thing she could do is create a new model whereby the First Lady does not have to give up being a private citizen merely because her husband is elected president. Not likely, though. I think in life, most of the things are not under our control. "My life has been like that," Columba told the Miami Herald in 1999. "I try to enjoy whatever comes." This was copyrighted by the Atlantic Media Company in 2015, and first published in The Atlantic magazine. On the health and science page now, cholesterol game changer on the way. Two breakthrough cholesterol drugs that could prevent heart attacks and strokes are expected to win Food and Drug Administration approval this summer. A federal advisory panel last week gave the green light to Repatha, developed by Amgen Pharmaceuticals, and Praluent from Sanofi and partner Regeneron. Known as PCSK9 inhibitors, these injectable antibodies block a protein that restricts the liver's ability to clear the blood of artery-clogging LDL, or, quote, bad cholesterol. And they may prove to be a safer as well as more powerful alternative to statins, the most commonly used anti-cholesterol drug. During clinical trials, the experimental medications reduced harmful cholesterol levels by more than 60%, according to two studies published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Early short-term trials suggest that they may cut a patient's risk of major cardiovascular problems in half, though definitive evidence from larger studies won't be available until 2017. This is one of the biggest developments in a long time in cardiology, Dr. Stephen Neeson, the leader of the study of Repatha, tells the Washington Post. The effects of these drugs are very robust. A Viagra for women. Otherwise healthy women who suffer from low sexual desire may soon have their own pink version of the little blue pill. Twice rejected by the FDA, Sprout Pharmaceuticals' flibanserin, was finally recommended for approval by a federal advisory committee, the New York Times reports. It's been dubbed female Viagra. But flibanserin works differently from the widely used treatment for erectile dysfunction in men. Male Viagra increases blood flow to the genitals. Flibanserin alters women's brain chemistry to boost libido. Although the FDA panel has cleared a path for the drug's sale in the United States next year, the committee's decision is not without controversy or conditions. Initially developed as an antidepressant, flibanserin must be taken daily, not just when intimacy is desired. The drug can cause fainting, nausea, dizziness, and sudden drops in blood pressure, and doctors may be required to warn patients about possible interactions with other medications or alcohol. Opponents contend these risks are not outweighed by the drug's limited benefits. During clinical trials, women taking flibanserin reported having just one more satisfying sexual encounter per month than usual. For some women, that's enough. Critics say the improvement might only be modest, said Catherine Campbell, who testified before the FDA committee. But oh, what I would give for even a modest improvement. On the Talking Points page, Rachel Dolezal, can a white woman identify as black? It's hard to think of a more bizarre story or one more representative of contemporary America than that of Rachel Dolezal, said Frederick Deber in the Los Angeles Times. An academic and civil rights activist, Dolezal, 37, claimed she was black for about a decade, served as president of the Spokane, Washington chapter of the NAACP, and taught African American studies at a local university. But last week, following a local TV investigation into racist hate mail she claimed to have received, Dolezal's estranged parents came forward to reveal that their daughter was in fact Caucasian, and that she's been living most of her adult life as a lie. They released photos of her as a pale, freckled-faced teenager with strawberry blonde hair and blue eyes, and revealed that she'd been passing off her black adopted brother as her own son. In the ensuing media firestorm, Dolezal resigned from the NAACP, but insisted in a TV interview, "I identify as black." But why? My theory? In the academic and civil rights worlds Dolezal has inhabited, black women are seen as more authentic, more wise, and more admirable than the kind of thing you might want to borrow. "The level of flat-out deception is unforgivable, said Mary Elizabeth Williams in Salon.com. Dolezal allegedly secured a scholarship at Howard University, known as the Black Harvard, by implying that she was black in her application. She claimed her parents were biracial and that they beat her as a child with a kind of whip used on slaves. With her afro or braided hair, her long and brightly colored nails, and her large and chunky jewelry, Dolezal has essentially been wearing blackface," said Osamudia James in WashingtonPost.com. "But blackness isn't something you can borrow with a black woman costume. Black identity is rooted in lived, day-to-day racial experience, including enduring in the face of prejudice. Dolezal's blackness was a performance." Dolezal's actions are a little weird, but at least she put her money where her mouth is, said John McWhorter in Time.com. "So many young white people today try to adopt cultural aspects of blackness, such as speech patterns, clothing, and music. But whereas these posers operate from within the cozy confines of middle-class white existence, Dolezal actually abandoned her white identity and presented herself as black to society. If liberals have accepted Bruce slash Caitlyn Jenner, why can't they accept Dolezal as transracial?" asked Sean Davis in TheFederalist.com. "Biologically speaking, Jenner isn't a woman and Dolezal isn't black. But they both feel so uncomfortable in their own skins that they've adopted new identities. How can you logically square the belief that Jenner is a hero while Dolezal is a mental case?" Simple, said Jonathan Capehart in WashingtonPost.com. Dolezal spun an elaborate web of lies to hide her real identity, concocting a black father and a childhood scarred by racism and deprivation. Jenner never pretended to have been born a female. She has openly described the inner torment she's always felt as a male, and said that by transitioning, she was becoming her true self. Had Dolezal aligned herself with the black community without staging a bizarre minstrel show of phony blackness, there would have been no controversy. "But if both race and gender are mere social constructs," said Charles Cook in NationalReview.com, "why can't Dolezal simply decide she's black? In our subjective new liberal reality, personal feelings can trump science and biology. Anyone who denies that Caitlyn Jenner is a woman is now denounced as a bigot. So what happens if Dolezal claims that people who deny her essential blackness are excluding her from real heritage, and that society has a responsibility to adapt so that she feels welcome? Soon, racial identity may become as fluid as gender." "Racial identity has always been a very complex subject," said Jelani Cobb in NewYorker.com. "Nearly all African Americans have some white blood because of the institutionalized rape during and after slavery. How much black ancestry do you need to be authentically black? We are not in the business of checking membership cards. Inclusion within the black community is essentially taken on trust. As someone who studied the delicacies of race in great detail, Dolezal knew full well the exact nature of the trust she violated. For blacks," said Tamara Winfrey Harris in NYTimes.com, "racial identity has always been set by whites. One drop of black blood and you're black. I will accept Dolezal as black, like me, only when society can accept me as white like her. And some short notes while we're here on the Talking Points page. The two deadliest drugs in America are both legal. Tobacco kills more than 500,000 Americans a year. Alcohol is linked to 88,000 deaths a year, including those caused by drunk driving and violent behavior, and more than 4.6 million emergency room visits. Some 480,000 suspects are currently locked up in American jails awaiting trial. About 75% of them are low-level offenders accused of nonviolent infractions and are in jail simply because they can't afford to post bail. About 15% of Medicare recipients accounted for 41% of the $324 billion spent on Medicare in 2012. These sickest seniors often have six or more chronic ailments, such as diabetes, heart disease, asthma, and Alzheimer's. Rancho Santa Fe, an ultra-wealthy San Diego hamlet, normally uses five times more water per capita than the statewide average. When Californians were told to reduce water consumption by 25%, its consumption rose by 9%. We pay significant property taxes based on where we live, said resident Steve Ujas. And no, we're not all equal when it comes to water. On the poll watch, 35% of Americans have a favorable opinion of Jeb Bush. 50% have an unfavorable view of him. And we'll finish with a quote from Irma Bombeck. All of us have moments in our lives that test our courage. Taking children into a house with a white carpet is one of them. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138. So long until next time.